Intelligent design and DNA. And scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Inyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, you and I have been into this paper by this infamous evolutionist.
Yes, the Holy Grail of evolution.
Yes, Theodosius Dobzhansky, 40 years ago, wrote the most famous evolution article ever, and it's titled, Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution. Well, you and I have been going through a paper that I had published in the Creation Research Society Quarterly. So, Fred, where we left off in his paper is that Dobzhansky is going to talk about DNA and genetics. When you look at inanimate matter and you realize that to go from inanimate matter to life, there are these unfathomable hurdles that would need to be crossed.
The law of biogenesis.
Yeah, right. That life only comes from life, biogenesis. It turns out that when Darwin and other evolutionists to this day, they say, well, if you have just the right chemicals, life will just arise. And so we analyze that in my paper. If you had an assembly line of trillions of worlds, forget about just our world, filled with random chemical reactions, after a trillion years, they finally assembled and folded a first protein into some kind of a usable form. All you'd have is a non-living protein molecule.
Nothing.
What would that do for you? It wouldn't do anything.
Wouldn't do much.
For anybody.
Do you remember our friend Stephen Hawking?
Yes.
Didn't he have a bunch of typing monkeys that were trying to do the same thing?
Yes. You end up, you get nothing after trillions of years. So, well, you know, he is insignificant, Stephen Hawking, because he says that the whole world is insignificant.
Yep.
So he must be especially insignificant. So, Fred, we point out that on Earth, there are deceased organisms, and as they are decomposing, there are quadrillions of dead proteins that are decaying, yet nothing ever comes from them. And forget, you know, they like to say billions, billions, billions of years, right? Forget about billions of years and trillions of worlds. Everything needed to form the first reproducing organism would all have to be present at the same moment in the same microsphere. It's all got to be there at the same time.
And it is, isn't it? It's all these trillions of things dying today.
Right.
It's all there. What's wrong? Why doesn't it create life?
Right. So life doesn't happen unless it's coming from life. Yet those who believe in materialistic origins, they have tremendous faith, and I'd have to say it's blind faith.
Yep.
They hold it with a religious dogma type of belief. But Fred, you know how environmentalists, they get so upset when they talk about a species going extinct? There are millions of species in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if a species goes extinct, that's a big problem.
It's a big deal, and it's all over the
press. I agree. You know, it's sad at some level, unless it's a cockroach. But it is sad, you know, when a species goes extinct. But they say, well, if one species goes extinct, there's a chain reaction and there's such a mess in the ecosystem. Well, what they ignore, they think the first species just arose by itself. Well, then what other species are there to help it?
Well, that's a great observation. So this is kind of backwards, right?
Yeah.
That's a really good observation.
Yeah. How about the circle of life? How about a diverse diet?
So the,
what's it going to eat?
Yeah.
What species are going to be there to provide it with biological services?
So one species goes extinct and, you know,
it's the end of the world.
It's the end of the world. And there's this huge impact. And yet, if you look at it, they believe their blind faith that you've got this single species starting from scratch.
And it's going to do everything.
It's going to do everything without any impact, obviously.
The whole ecosystem.
Incredible faith, just like you said.
Yes, yes. Now, Dobzhansky, he never gets around to explaining why diversity, all the different kinds of organisms in the world, why that is evidence against creation instead of for creation. He doesn't explain that, Fred, and he doesn't say whether God would have had to completely avoid niche species to meet with his approval. You know?
Yeah.
His article is a good example of all the anti-creation authors who do not distinguish between evidence, actual evidence for their claim, and their own rhetoric. They present their conclusions as though they were argumentation.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how many times I've seen it. Your friend and mine, Walter Remine,
yeah. You know,
he's done some great work for the world of creation. And I love his analogy. You know, he used to do magic, and mm-hmm. he sees the illusion behind these things. And really, a lot of this, they're just masters of illusion. And one mm-hmm. of them is what you just talked about. They present interpretations as though they were observations.
Mm.
So interpretations are really observations. They create the illusion of scientific proof by misdirecting the reader's attention. I mean, they do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Their opinions are somehow sold as fact. That is so common.
Right.
I mean, I was brainwashed by a lot of this stuff for years because you're thinking, man, these guys are smart. They know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
If you dig into it, it's not evidence. It's just their interpretation.
Their conclusion presented as though it were evidence.
That's right. That's right.
For their conclusion.
Yeah. So then, great point here, Bob. Dobzhansky talks about how DNA is everywhere, that life arose from inanimate matter only once.
So wait, he says DNA is everywhere. It is too, right?
Yeah.
In living yep. plants and animals, it's everywhere.
And then he says that life arose from inanimate matter only once.
So what, the DNA proves that life arose just once. So that's his claim.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then he contradicts himself that it is also possible that there were several or even many origins of life.
Wait,
make up your mind.
Wait a minute now. And he does this like the universe is a billion years old or infinite years old. It's like, that's quite
that's a
stretch.
Big gap.
And so here it is again. So is this a scientific conclusion he's making? He says DNA shows that life arose only once. Or maybe it rose many times.
So, that is so compelling, Bob. I've had it. I'm leaving. I'm taking off my headset
yeah,
here, and I'm leaving
right.
the studio because it's so overwhelming. Yeah. I have to believe in evolution.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. It's the point we made earlier in this series, applied science, like how airplanes fly and telephones work. That's very different from origins philosophy mm-hmm. or even origins science, because these are just philosophical guesses he's offering here. And evolutionists around the world think it's all brilliant assessment of the data. And Fred, you know, at this point, Dobzhansky mocks God.
He mocks God.
Just
yeah.
outright.
And he's supposed to be a Christian, right? He claims to be a Christian.
A Christian who doesn't believe in life after death.
I can claim to be a good racquetball player. That doesn't make it so.
No, right, exactly. In fact, Jesus said, many will say, Lord, Lord, and mm-hmm. I will say, I never knew you. Depart from me into everlasting fire.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said the weeds will grow up with the wheat, the tares
yes.
with the wheat, and there will be wolves in sheep's clothing. So Dobzhansky saying he's a Christian is such a mockery.
Oh, yeah.
But
he says in a fit of absent-mindedness, the creator went on to create a myriad of fruit flies. Mm-hmm. So the creator in a fit of absent-mindedness.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
So he's criticizing God for making so many different kinds of fruit flies. Well, he should have got around to beetles. There's like a third of a million different beetle species. There's a lot of beetles. Insects generally, there's about a million kinds of insects, and they're amazing.
I think variety's cool. I mean, I went shopping for a car for my teenage son.
Yeah.
I'm glad there just wasn't the Yugo to go look at.
Right.
A red Yugo or a blue Yugo
yeah, right.
or a polka dot Yugo.
Yeah.
No, yeah, we can
variety,
look at F-150s,
yeah.
all these different great...
Variety is the spice of life.
It is,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Viva la difference.
All these engineers that built all these cars, they must have done it in a fit of absent-mindedness.
I guess so, right? Very good point. So now what he's offered here by mocking God because there are so many kinds of fruit flies, that's not a scientific argument. It's a philosophical argument. You know, what law of science is there? Is it physics or chemistry? Or what is it that limits how much diversity a creator may implement? You know, that's not science. That's philosophy.
Absolutely.
It's the intelligent design argument used badly. He's saying, well, if there was a designer, he wouldn't make so many fruit flies.
I would say probably about 90% of his article is philosophy.
You are exactly right, Fred. And so he mocks God, saying God is absent-minded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of absent-mindedness, Dobzhansky himself must have been forgetful while he was writing this article. He's the one who forgot something. He forgot to explain why DNA, why biological universals, he says they're the most impressive evidence for evolution and against creation. Well, why? Why,
yeah, explain
Theo?
That, yeah.
Why? If there's a creator, first he says a creator cannot make a lot of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Then he says, well, a creator can't make one kind of biological universal. So which is it? He can't do too much the same, or he can't do too much different?
And it kind of ties back to DNA, like you said. And it's interesting that the co-discoverer of DNA, Francis Crick, saw that DNA actually was a coding language. And coding languages can't come from natural processes. So he rejected this very theory that Dobzhansky presents that, you know, he champions. He rejected it in favor of aliens.
He said it must be aliens.
Yeah.
Right.
Because he saw that that has to come from intelligence. And he said the intelligence was aliens.
Yeah. So that is an option. A lot of people realize there's either a God who made us and loves us, or there's aliens who perhaps are going to come down like in spaghetti monster ships and attack us, like Stephen Hawking believes.
Yeah.
He actually believes in the flying spaghetti monster. Even in real life, not as a joke, in real life. And he says, watch out. When you see the aliens, don't talk to them. So Dobzhansky is the father of neo-Darwinism. That is the merging of evolution and DNA. That's what neo-Darwinism is.
Yeah, basically natural selection and mutations, right?
Yes, exactly. And the whole genetic code and genes and all that.
Yep.
And so what he did was he oversold and misinterpreted the genetic science of his day. He led many scientists and reporters in the world to believe that their very beginning of figuring out the order of, you know, the DNA molecule, the sequencing of proteins and all, he led them to believe that all the evidence was in, all they needed, and it cast the deciding vote for evolution. And he said, look, when we look at the DNA, we can make exact measurements. This is absurd how utterly proven false this has become.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you refer to the 98 to 99% similarity between humans and chimp DNA. I mean, I heard that argument before I really got interested in this topic, but it has a lot of force. It's an illusion in itself, because even 2% differences is way too much mathematically for us to be related to chimps. That's another argument.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the time where they were pushing that argument. Very powerful illusion behind it.
40 years ago, in his paper, 1973, Dobzhansky said that the genetic science had reached a point where they can make exact measurements as to the degrees of similarity and differences between different animals and plants. So he was saying, you look at the DNA and you sequence the proteins, and we could tell you exactly how close or how far away something is. He was way overselling that.
In fact, it's a fabrication. I mean, in order to tell the differences, you really need to sequence the whole thing. And they had sequenced a small amount, and
tiny,
they were making extrapolations, and he's making claims that they had exact measurements. As you point out in the article, this is where that whole 98 to 99% chimp DNA similarity with humans came.
Right.
You know, that's an argument I heard even before I got involved in this topic. And it has a powerful illusion behind it. You know, just having that particular piece of evidence, sure, that sounds like we're close to chimps. If we're 98 to 99% similar, that sounds pretty close.
Yeah, it does.
But, you know, first of all, those weren't exact measurements. And as we know, let's wind into the future now, 40 years, and we know that none of that's true. We're not near that similar. But even if we were 2% different than chimps, we also know that the mathematics, even at that level, didn't support us being related to chimps. It was mathematically implausible, as other evolutists, mathematicians showed.
For example, let's say we were 98.5%. Well, there's 3 billion base pairs in the human DNA. 3 billion. That means 10% is 300 million nucleotides. 1% is 30 million. So it turns out now, forget about 1.5, we're more like 5%. And that's not even counting, you know, the Y chromosome and all that. So 5% means there are 150 million differences, 150 million between the chimp and the human DNA. And there's only about 5 million years to get from there to here. And they say it happens so slowly you can't see it, but it's got to go speeding at the speed of light to get here from there.
Yeah, and famous evolutionist Haldane showed that you could only get, based on his math, 1,600 changes over 10 million years. 1,600 beneficial changes over that period of time, and if you're 2% different, that was going to be 30 million changes that you needed, and like you said, 5% is 150 million. That was a bridge that they couldn't overcome.
Yeah.
Well, as it turns out now, we were not 98% similar. They've had the ability now to
see that there's more and more difference than they ever
admitted.
And they
still cheat, because they won't count the genes that the chimps have and that we don't.
Okay, in fact, Fred, our board operator for Real Science Radio, Jamie Schofield, he likes to point out that if this were true, right, they say we've been evolving for 5 million years since chimps, and you need 150 million changes. Well, that'd be 30 changes per year relentlessly, all in the right direction. And what's interesting, you have kids and I have kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's say one of our kids had the right mutation to help the human race evolve.
And only half of them will get the right one, right? Because there's two of us, you know, mom and dad.
Mom and dad.
And, you know, we're each going to get one gene from the
yeah.
You know, so
right.
There's a 50% hurdle to start with.
That you're going to lose it.
Yeah.
But then, so they have this gene. How many years will it take for one of our kids to get that mutation to propagate itself through the whole human race?
Yeah.
Right.
Because then they have to have kids, their kids have to have kids.
Yeah.
And they have to keep going over that 50% hurdle. And you know, there's all kinds of other hurdles. What about the kid that never has any other kids? You know, you survive up to parenthood. There's all kinds of factors that come into play.
Yeah.
And they don't account for all those harmful mutations that are making this beneficial one pretty much impossible to see through all the noise of all the harmful ones.
To me, it's so powerful just to think about your own kid and think about your kid getting married. Having a few kids and they get married and they have a few kids and pretty soon you got 80 people among your descendants. Say there's only 1 million people or 100 million or billion.
Mm-hmm.
How long before your kid's mutation is going to be in every kid in the world?
Yeah.
And that has to happen, like Jamie points out, 30 times every year, propagating through the whole species relentlessly for 5 million years. Haldane was an evolutionist. The evolutionists today dismiss him because if he was right, then they're wrong.
Absolutely.
And he was wrong too, because he was an evolutionist.
Yeah.
Fred, we have another prediction, our Real Science Radio predictions, and we're going to do a whole show on the RSR predictions.
Need probably more than one show.
Yeah, that'll be great. But this one is that the evolutionists are not going to be in a hurry to redo the chimp genome. Because they did the chimp genome on the cheap. They didn't spend a lot of money on it. They did it when the technology wasn't as good. And they used the human genome as their framework.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called, there's a technical word for this. This is called cheating. They took the human genome and they would get little sequences of, you know, 20 amino acids in a row here, or nucleotides, and 40 there and 112 there and 18 there. And they paste them up onto the human genome. And then that was it. They published the chimp genome. So surprise, surprise. It was a bit more like the human genome than it turns out to really be. Surprise. And they haven't been in a rush to do it right. And I don't think they're going to be, because the more they get these high quality genomes, the more they contradict the tree of life and the whole Darwinian story.
Yeah, you know, the chimp Y chromosome, they actually sequenced the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And guess what? It was 30% different than human.
Yeah, the evolutionists said it was horrendously different.
Different, yes. They call it horrendously different than the male Y chromosome.
Yeah.
30% different. Right. You know, it reminds me.
Horrendous is a scientific term.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, 30%, that kind of reminds me of the sponge.
Oh, yeah.
Don't they have 70% genes that are similar to us?
Yes, that's exactly right. So sponge genes. And Fred, they have genes for things that we humans have. I'm talking about a sponge. For things that they don't even have, like nerves. Sponges don't have nerves. Muscles? Sponges don't have muscles. So what's with this? This contradicts evolutionary theory that a sponge that's supposed to be way down at the base of the tree of life, you know, hundreds of millions of years old, that a sponge would have genes for nerves and muscles.
Yeah. Well, you quote an evolutionist here from the Smithsonian, paleobiologist Douglas Irwin. He admitted that this flies in the face of what we think of early evolution. Flies in the face? Is that a scientific phrase?
It's more flies.
Yeah.
Dobzhansky be turning in his grave. So, yeah, it's interesting that evolutionists today, Fred, they're constantly saying how surprised they are, shocked even, horrified at the findings in the DNA that contradict what they expected as Darwinists.
We need to do a show on all the words, all these, you know, horrendous, surprised, shocked, mystified.
Yes. We need to start over. Go back to the drawing board.
So you've got a table here that actually goes through comparing the genes of humans with all the various animals.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good table here. I think, boy, you got to get the magazine. Creation Research Society.
Yeah.
So which edition is it?
The Spring 2013.
Spring 2013, creationresearch.org. And you can, now right now it's online in the members area, but we encourage you to become a member and support the Creation Research Society.
Yeah.
They do great work.
And then you'll get one.
You'll get one. They send out 4 a year, and you also get
Creation Matters.
It's a newsletter that's really good also. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so you've got a table here that lists all these. Now, we just talked about one, about the Y chromosome being mm-hmm. horrendously different. You also mentioned that horse DNA is closer to bats than to cows. Wait a minute. Wait, so if I look at a horse, now, Bob, come on, I think the horse looks like a bat, so I think you're wrong on this one.
Okay, Fred, and these, of course, they're all referenced to peer-reviewed papers.
Yeah. All peer-reviewed papers that are all evolutionist papers.
So this isn't if Darwin's coming... tree of life was right, would a horse be closer to a bat than a cow? No.
Nope.
Right.
So another one you have here is kangaroo DNA unexpectedly contains huge chunks of the human genomes.
Yeah. And the project head in Australia was shocked.
Shocked.
That. She said, what in the world are these huge chunks of human DNA doing smack dab in the middle of Joey's DNA?
Yeah.
Of the kangaroo's DNA.
She wasn't jumping for joy, right?
No, she wasn't.
Okay, so the next one is Neanderthal DNA is closer to human than a chimp is to a chimp.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. Okay, so we know that Neanderthals really are humans.
They're
right?
human. They're not some kind of primate species.
No.
They're human.
And there's plenty of evolutionists that now admit that. You know,
right. But they didn't a while back ago, at least leading ones, like Ian Tattersall and all, who wrote the book, literally.
Theodotus Dobzhansky.
Yeah, right. On Neanderthal. Said, we know Neanderthal is a different species.
So again, Neanderthal DNA is closer to another human than a chimp is to a chimp.
Yeah.
So, but yet you'll still have people say that Neanderthals aren't fully human.
Right.
Okay, the next one.
That's because chimps are not fully chimp, you know.
Yeah.
That's
right.
You know, to an evolutionist, a chicken is a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Not that. Yeah. They used to say chickens evolved from dinosaurs. Fred, the last time I read an article about that was today, brand new article, that chickens are dinosaurs. Okay.
The roundworm has far more genes than Darwinists presumed. They have 19,000 genes. Now, how many do we have?
The roundworm is a simple creature.
Simple. That's the word they'll use, right?
Yeah, it's really so complex. It is complex. But compare it to, like,
simple to complex. You wouldn't think that something would have 19,000.
Yeah, we have 20,500 genes.
So we outdid them by 1,500 genes.
That's it.
By about 10%.
Yeah, and that surprises evolutionists. Why should this tiny little roundworm that is relatively so simple have, you know, almost as many genes as humans? It's all contradictory to the expectations of the Darwinian tree of life.
Okay, University of California Davis study compared 2,000 genes common to humans, frogs, sea squirts, sea urchins, fruit flies, and nematodes to construct an evolutionary tree. They failed because, quote-unquote, different genes told contradictory evolutionary stories. That's pretty powerful.
And that's a new scientist.
And that was comparing quite a wide range of organisms, right?
2,000 genes and all these different...
Yep.
And they said they just couldn't build the tree of life. Everything contradicted everything else.
So, Bob, I'm shocked that it showed a contradictory evolutionary story.
Shocked.
I'm just so shocked.
It always does. So it turns out that many career evolutionists admit that Darwin was wrong about the tree of life, and that comes right out of New Scientist, which is the leading British science magazine.
I don't think Aaron Raw ever got that issue.
No, I guess not. And so, Fred, what Dobzhansky did back in 1973 was he trumpeted this tiny set of genetic data points from which he drew these irresponsible conclusions. They looked at this tiny region of DNA for 18 species, so a tiny little segment for a small group of species, and that segment coded for something called cytochrome C. You know about these kinds of arguments. And Fred, he said that this one nucleotide, like one letter in the DNA, there was a single letter difference between humans and gorillas, whereas between human and chimp, they were identical. But Freddy's only looking at 141 letters out of billions. So what would have happened then if he would have just looked at, say, a different set of 141?
Picks and chooses. So he chooses cytochrome C. Well, let's go back a letter. Let's go to cytochrome B.
Oh,
what would have happened if he would have chose B?
Well, Fred, I quote a peer-reviewed article about cytochrome B, and they say, you know, if we look at the relationship of mammals with cytochrome B, you end up getting cats and whales grouping with monkeys and apes. So think about that. You got monkeys and apes, and right there with them, cats and whales.
Yep.
Right. It's all crazy. So it's just convenient that he looked at this little tiny segment and he said, oh, there's the proof of evolution right there, where you look at the whole genome and in hundreds of species and it all falls apart.
That's right. Well, Bob, I was honored that you actually referenced my website in your paper.
Oh, hey, yeah.
My name, Williams, 2008, right here in the paper.
That's right. That was a great article you had on your evolution forum.
It was a lot of fun. This was on Cytochrome C. Basically, there was a guy on the forum, he posted this. He said that cytochrome C is very unique because it paints an obvious picture of common descent. By examining the differences in the genetic code, we can examine how different the species are. Mm. So what I did was I posted a test. I showed them a chart of the cytochrome C with 30 animals. Except I did something different here. I didn't show what the animals were. I labeled them animal 1 through animal 30.
You didn't put like giraffe and cat, and you didn't do that.
That's right. I asked evolutionists on the forum, hey, somebody want to take this test? Why don't you run this through your simulation or whatever you want to do and tell me the relationships? Because you've just made a bold claim that you can use cytochrome C to point out these ancestral relationships.
Yeah. Wow, what a great idea, Fred.
Yeah, so, you know.
This is a blind test.
Yeah.
That's great.
There's a guy named Numbers. That's his moniker on the forum. He prides himself in being really good at numbers, and he is pretty good at numbers. You know, I think he's a mathematician.
Yeah.
So he happily took the challenge, and he provided his answer. He provided the list of what this chart would show, and then another evolutionist jumped in and goes, oh man, you beat me to it, but yeah, that looks really good. You know, they're patting each other on the back.
Yeah, that they could figure out the tree of life based on the sequence.
Yeah. I showed what the actual animals were, and oops. So for example, they had the elephant seal and dog sharing a very recent ancestor. So more close to a dog than anything else, basically.
Right.
The bat is closer to a dog than other mammals, so they're closer to, you know, bats and dogs.
That's fun.
Sheeps and pigs share a very recent ancestor.
Very recent.
It doesn't fit the evolutionary paradigm. And then here's a good one. The gray whales and camels, they were really close to each other. So the camel must have jumped in the water and quickly evolved into a whale. They got lucky on one. There was only one that actually would fit their paradigm, and everything else was either way off, like I pointed out, or it was too ambiguous, or it fit within the biblical kind. For example, a rat and a mouse were similar. And we would say that they're pretty similar, too.
Right,
so
exactly.
No shockers there. So there were some that fell within the kind.
All of them that they got right. So that's...
Yeah, and so then the forum, this whole thread took on a whole nother, theme. It was great, because then... Everybody pounced on the evolutionists, and they were trying to backtrack and defend themselves.
That's so fun, and that's why we reference that. What a great job, Fred. And then, Fred, we reference these peer-reviewed journals that say, look, camels and llamas share the same sequence with sharks. And they say, bats and dolphins, bingo, same thing. And on, it's so funny to see how the genetic data, it really contradicts Dobzhansky and Darwin in a big way.
Yep.
So thank you, Fred Williams.
Thanks, Bob.
Another fun Real Science Radio. Our website, realscienceradio.com. That's what I'm talking about.